Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. And on our show today, we're going to be talking with Christine Mumma, lawyer and director of the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence, about the ethics of wrongful conviction. And Christy, this is something I'm interested in. I think lots of our listeners across the state and across the country are interested in, and maybe potentially how this relates to kind of the health effects of people in prison and those who long-term about wrongful convictions.
I'm looking forward to the conversation. But first, Adam, before we go there, we've got some really good research that matters to people. We're going to talk about green tea and cholesterol, about mammograms.
Yeah, if you're low risk, how often do you need them? Maybe you can space them out a little bit. What about arthritis and your exposure to chemicals that you see on pans like Teflon?
And about men with cancer being more likely to die than women.
I don't like that one, Christy.
No. It bodes well for me, but not you.
Let's talk about the very first one that is an equal opportunity, which is cholesterol. And I do actually have high cholesterol. So this is actually something I was really interested in. It's about green tea. Which we've heard a lot of putative health benefits for, but here it's does it actually help lower your cholesterol?
And green tea, it tastes good, but the truth is that not a lot of Americans drink green tea on a regular basis. This is a study that was in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition to review 14 different studies that have been done to see if there's a real difference in drinking green tea compared with drinking some other kind of tea or other kind of drink.
Yeah, and what was really quite interesting is, you know, the randomized controlled trials are gold standard for really looking at this, and these studies were anywhere from 3 weeks to 3 months. And really, on average, those who ended up having the green tea did have lower cholesterol levels, about 2% lower. And that may not seem like a lot, but, you know, if you had a cholesterol value of 220, that might be 5 points or so, 4 or 5 points. And that's better than it going up.
And that drop was in the bad cholesterol. There was no change in the good cholesterol.
Correct.
But the drop was in the bad cholesterol. So if you looked at it more on a population level, like if the whole country drank a whole lot more green tea, then maybe there'd be a little more benefit broadly. I think of this as, you know, green tea, it's probably got some small benefits to your cholesterol. It's certainly not a treatment if you have high cholesterol.
Yep. And if a little bit is good, a lot here is not better.
Not
we don't want you, because there has been liver toxicity in very large doses of green tea. So this is one of those things you can add to your armamentarium of things you can do with diet and maybe supplements to lower your cholesterol. And if you're having one or two cups a day, it's certainly okay for us.
Okay, the next one's about mammograms. So as everybody knows, there were some controversial data and new recommendations from that USPSTF.
United States Preventive Task Force,
Preventive Services Task Force, which is, you know, a very trusted source for prevention, where they really look at the benefits and risks of our various recommendations, saying that for people over 50, that maybe doing mammograms every 2 years is the new recommendation, that we don't need to do them every year the way we've been stressing.
Unless you're in a high-risk group, or unless for some reason that the doctor and the patient jointly agree that
exactly. This
is the way it should be monitoring. We just discussed recently that the radiation dose is not high, but getting biopsied unnecessarily, you want to certainly decrease.
This study really pushes that further, and this was a study looking at even less frequent mammograms for women who are at low risk for breast cancer. So pushing that from every 2 years to every 3 to 4 years for certain patients.
Yeah, and this was actually published in the Annals of Internal Medicine. And they also looked at the cost of the different screening recommendations. So, you know, if you take a group of women who are very low risk, they've had negative mammograms 3 or 4 times, and they don't have dense breasts, and there's no family history of breast cancer, the risk of coming up with a false positive is pretty high compared to the risk of a true positive. So they suggested that those women might be able to have mammograms not every 2 years after age 50, but every 3 or maybe even every 4 years. What do you think about that, Christy?
Well, I think it's important for us to look at, and I think like many of these recommendations and studies, we need to have a conversation with our patients about their values, about what the current recommendations
values,
are.
Values, Christy?
Their values. Like some people, I mean, I have a lot of patients who are like, I want the minimum number. I'll do what you tell me to do, but I don't want to get a mammogram every year unless you can tell me that there's good proof that that's going to make a difference, because I don't want to have to deal with all these extra biopsies.
I think you're right. And even flexibility, because they suggest there may be some value. the other extent, the value that says, you know, I really believe that the science ultimately will prove, or I really want this done more frequently. So there's some flexibility they urge in these guidelines.
So it's a combination of knowing this evidence and also the patient's values. And certainly if you don't have all these things that make you low risk, then doing them every 2 years or perhaps every year is reasonable.
Yeah. Well, let's look at our very next research that matters. That relates to arthritis. And I'm going to ask a question right now, Christy. Is how many of our listeners right now have arthritis? Raise your hands.
Well,
I can just see and hear all of the hands going up all over the radio out here.
Well, and the other question is, how many people cook with nonstick cooking pots, like using that Teflon no-stick coating?
And my hand is on it. Well, we're not saying that that causes arthritis, but this is a really interesting research that was from the American Journal of Epidemiology that actually looked at an environmental exposure, a catastrophe, you might say, from a DuPont plant in West Virginia, where there was in 2001, there was a settlement of a class action lawsuit, but where these PFOAs, these exposures from the plant that went up into the air and then ended up coming back down and contaminating the drinking water. And in this particular study, was a relationship between people who ingested this and development of arthritis.
And, I mean, looking at this, the people who had the contaminated water with these PFOAs in them did have a 40% higher risk of developing arthritis. And so, you know, that sounds really concerning. It's not necessarily that if you get exposed to this, you will develop arthritis, but there's some sort of a link there.
Well, and the reason we just mentioned the Teflon is that these PFOAs is one of the chemicals that is in Teflon. And so there's absolutely no evidence that Teflon is what causes this or any element. But we just say, you know, this raises questions. There needs to be more research on it. But it raised my shackles just a little bit, Christy. I went, huh.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to go out and buy all new pans, but
I'm going to my iron skillet a little more often.
I am too. I was thinking the same thing.
Well, again, we just found this interesting. We hope you do too. And let's think about our last research that matters, Christy. And this is about—
This is sad for you.
American men. Well, American men are diagnosed with cancer. They're more likely to die than women. And yeah, it is sad for men and across the United States.
Well, and for their spouses.
Yeah.
So this is from the National Cancer Institute, a study looking at a big database of 36 different types of cancer going back all the way from 1977 to 2006. And basically they found that men are more likely to die than women from multiple different types of cancer. And it has to
do with things like lung cancer or esophageal cancer, where unfortunately, men maybe do some of the risk factors like drinking and smoking more often than women. So some of it is, okay, well, they do these behaviors more often. They're more likely to get the cancer. They're more likely to die from the cancer.
But so part of it is that men are more likely to develop the cancers, as you're saying. But also, the men tend to present later to the doctor. So they're getting their diagnosis when the cancer is more advanced. And therefore, they're more likely to die from it.
They're not going in for their mammograms for their every 2 years. They're not going in for physicals as often.
For their colon cancer screening.
Once they're coughing, they're not coming in and getting that treated or diagnosed early. So they're getting diagnosed maybe at later stages.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And so what's our advice?
I mean, our advice is it's hard to get men to go to the doctor, and we've talked about this before. But, you know, for all of you men out there, even if you feel healthy, make sure you've got a doctor that you identify as your primary doctor, that you're going periodically for your routine checkup, and that if you have a symptom, go get it checked out.
You know,
sounds logical, but
sucking it up is not a sign of strength. Well, that's going to conclude the research that matters. We've had a chance to talk about green tea in moderation, lowering cholesterol.
We talked about perhaps fewer mammograms needed for low-risk women.
Being more aware potentially of environmental issues as it relates to chemicals. We'll be following that.
And about American men with cancer being more likely to die than women, and men go to the doctor.
Yep. Well, that concludes Research That Matters. We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Christine Mumma about ethics of wrongful conviction. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we're going to be talking with attorney and director of the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence, Christine Mumma, about the ethics of wrongful conviction. Really a fascinating topic that on the surface of it maybe seems to be outside of the things that Christy and I might normally talk about on Your Health, but really right underneath that surface, it's everything we talk about, your health. It's about real people, their lives, the health of their families and communities, and public policy as it relates to, in this case, wrongful conviction of people across North Carolina and across the United States. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you for having me.
Chris, Adam and I would love to hear more about you first. We have so many things we want to hear about the people that you've helped come to justice. But how did you become on this mission to help the wrongfully accused?
I'd say I've always been kind of an idealistic person who, you know, cries when they do the pledge of allegiance and
a sentimental type.
So I've And I clerked at the North Carolina Supreme Court for 3 years, and that's really was the turning point, because that's where I saw cases where I had some questions about guilt or innocence and realized the limitations of the appellate process in answering that question. I don't think people realize that once the case leaves that jury, that question of guilt or innocence is off the table pretty much.
Well, you know, in our field of medicine, you know, I think it's commonly accepted that we don't always get the right diagnosis. We try our best, and people understand that you bring everything. And there's medical malpractice, and we would get to that, I think, in talking about it. But in the legal profession, is there an assumption that do people really believe that the process usually gets it right? And how often do we know that that is true or not true?
I think people want to believe the process gets it right. They, you know, you say the words justice and freedom and truth and liberty, and people want to believe that's all built into the system and that they're safe, because if it's not safe, then everybody's at risk. But when you step back and think about it, it's very much of a human system, actually much less science in it than you have in the medical field. So going through the process from beginning to end, where you have victims and witnesses and forensics and law enforcement and prosecutors and defense attorneys and judges and juries, there's humans everywhere. So the potential for human error occurs at every stage. So it's susceptible to humans making mistakes, which is why the policy part of what we do is so important.
I certainly want to get into the different factors that you've identified of things that can go wrong, like an eyewitness going wrong or an expert medical witness. But how common is this? What do we know? I mean, sort of like in medicine, one wrong diagnosis can be someone's life. And so even one is a tragic story. But is this, in your estimate, I guess it's a guess, but how common do you think this is?
We get that question a lot. There's been 272 DNA exonerations across the country. So that means people exonerated by conclusive biological proof. the number of non-DNA exonerations is probably three times as many. We really focus on the DNA because the biggest skeptics can't argue with those cases. But I also have a long list of cases in our office where I believe someone is innocent and there's nothing we can do about it. It is a fact that there are innocent people in prison who will die there because there's nothing that can be done in the post-conviction process to prove their innocence. So I think you're right. It happens. That's what we can say. There are some, and if there are some, then we have to do everything we possibly can to find them and make sure justice is done.
Well, when you're talking about cases that come before, there's a finite amount of resources that you have available to review cases and to put resources into them. Do you prioritize, you know, in other words, do you say, well, cases that are on death row are different than cases that involve rape or versus the difference than burglary? Do you try to prioritize based upon the seriousness of the potential consequences?
Well, we do have a criteria that says if you have less than 3 years left to serve, then we're less likely to take your case. We're going to give priority to someone who's looking at many years in prison to come. The death penalty cases is interesting. There's the Center for Death Penalty Litigation in Durham, which focuses on death penalty cases. If you're on death row, there's usually many attorneys who want to look at your case and make sure that the verdict was correct. If you have a life sentence, you usually are just tossed aside. You don't have a right to an attorney. There's not as many people willing to look at your case. So we don't take death penalty cases at the center because there is the dedicated Center for Death Penalty Litigation.
So it actually, I guess one of the, I don't know if it's the first case, but one of the most high profile, Greg Taylor, was someone who was convicted wrongfully of murder but wasn't on death row, was life imprisonment. Is that why you came across that case?
That's exactly right. It, even though he was going to be looked at for parole in 2012, it's very unlikely he would have gotten parole. People go up for parole many times before they ever get parole, if they ever do. So, yes, Greg was looking at a life sentence. Dwayne Dale was our first DNA exoneration case. He served almost 19 years in prison, went into prison when he was 20 years old.
And for a wrongful rape case.
That was for a rape case of a 12-year-old girl. Ah. It was a cross-race rape. So the brutalities he suffered in prison because of that were tremendous.
Well, one of the, Adam and I were talking about connections between what you do and what we do in medicine. And, you know, one of the things is this a non-judgmental approach. So we have many patients who maybe have had hard lives and made some choices that led them into a situation through drugs or alcohol or a variety of things. But yet we as physicians need to care for them and see past those choices and advocate for them and help them to the best of our ability. And I would imagine with some of the people that you work with, they may have made some mistakes in their lives that maybe got them in a situation. Maybe they did some burglary but didn't actually do the murder or something along those lines. And I wonder, you know, is what drives you the sense of justice, or does it also become about that human connection?
Well, it's both. If it's important to remember that if someone's innocent, the true perpetrator is on the street. So as in Dwayne's case, the true perpetrator of that rape committed more crimes after Dwayne was wrongfully convicted. We don't take cases where there's a reduced level of culpability. So in the case where they went with their buddies to commit a robbery, but they didn't know one of them had a gun and didn't intend for anybody to get hurt, that's not complete actual innocence. So for us to take their case, they have to have been not there, not involved at all.
We're talking with attorney Christine Uma, director of the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence, about the ethics of wrongful conviction. And, you know, Chris, one of the things that strikes me is there is this tension between the science that can help prove in the DNA, but also the narrative that you have to perhaps believe is true, that there's someone that is wrongfully convicted. And I think here in medicine, we frequently have this tension between the narrative of the experience and the science. How does that narrative impact you? Where does that come into play?
You're talking about the narrative I get from a defendant?
Sure, because what we would see on TV is all defendants are innocent.
Sure. And I clarify that it's not true that they all claim they're innocent. You know, defense attorneys, I talk to defense attorneys all the time and say, how many of your clients say they're innocent? And it just most of them say, listen, I did it. What are you going to do to help me get a reduced sentence? Or, you know, it happened, but I didn't mean for it to happen, kind of explanation. But there's no question that we have received claims from people where they say they're innocent, and then after going through all the facts or meeting with them, we have closed the case. So some of them do claim innocence, and we come to believe they are not innocent. So we do have to look at the evidence and look at the facts and determine whether there's new evidence that was never looked at before that we might follow up on. And that's what we hope for. We get about 1,000 claims a year. We reject about 95% of them for one reason or another. But sometimes it's because what they're saying is just not credible.
We do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Attorney Christine Mumma, about the ethics of wrongful conviction. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with attorney Christine Mumma about the ethics of wrongful conviction and her work to really advocate and investigate for people who are potentially wrongfully convicted. And there have been, you know, multiple cases with Duane Ellendale, I think we mentioned, and with Greg Taylor, both of which we talked about in the previous segment. But you know, when you really think about that, 19 years of someone's life, that you think about losing your family, all the things that happens to a person, what do we know, or what do you know, are the real effects to a person's life and to their mental health from being wrongfully convicted?
Sure. And although the defendant or the person who's wrongfully convicted is the most important, there are many people who are impacted by the wrongful conviction. In Duane's case, he had a very close family, sisters and brothers and parents who suffered for all those years along with him with the helplessness of not being able to do anything for him. He had his girlfriend was pregnant when he was convicted. Mm-hmm. So his son was born 7 months after he was convicted and spent 18 years, not only without a father, but with a father who was incarcerated for raping a 12-year-old child. So the consequences go way beyond the wrongfully convicted person. They also reach to the victim. After 19 years, this victim who thought she had resolution had to have all that brought back up again in her life and basically relive the entire situation. Then she had to go through the trial of the true perpetrator. The consequences of an injustice, the families, the friends, the victim, the defendant, and then the justice system overall, public confidence is hugely deteriorated when people hear about someone spending 19 years in prison for a crime they didn't commit, which was Chief Justice I. Beverly Lake's primary concern when he established the Actual Innocence Commission in 2002, was that loss of public confidence in our system.
Well, North Carolina... Was North Carolina the first state to have this sort of commission?
North Carolina was the first state to have an actual innocence commission with the 2002, which was established to look at issues associated with wrongful convictions, things like false confession, misidentification, lack of physical evidence. And then that led to the establishment of the Innocence Inquiry Commission in 2006, which is a commission that looks at actual cases, not issues, but cases. And we are also the first state in the country to have that type of commission.
Well, I know that's something to be proud about, that I've read some about other states replicating, but it also occurs to me that the types of people who maybe get wrongfully convicted are maybe disparately poor or have less education, less resources to really defend themselves at the front end of this situation. And that's an indictment of perhaps our legal system in some respects. Is that still the case, and what efforts do you or others do to help correct that? Because in medicine, we have Medicaid to help those on the one end. We have Medicare to help the seniors. What do we have in the legal remedies?
Sure. In 70% of the 272 exonerations are minorities. They are people who are vulnerable and indigent and have more likely to be wrongfully convicted if they have appointed counsel. And it is difficult to identify the cases and prove innocence in all the cases where someone has been wrongfully convicted. So you're correct. We have to focus on the front end and prevent it from happening in the first place. North Carolina has made tremendous progress in that area. We're the only state in the country with statutory law on covering the way identification needs to be conducted. Our minds are not recorders. We can't remember every detail. Our memory is a piece of evidence just like any other evidence that can be contaminated by exposure to television or TV or conversations with other people. So we have ID procedures that are followed statewide. We also require recording of interrogations in homicide cases. That's been expanded just this session to other violent felonies and juvenile interrogations. So we try and keep those false confessions from happening on the front end. Keith Brown is one of our North Carolina exonerees who was incarcerated for 4 years after signing a 17-page confession for a crime he did not commit.
And which this was the gentleman who was also had mentally incapable of writing such a confession.
That's actually Floyd Brown. So we've had two. Keith Brown was actually Keith was actually convicted. Floyd was held for 14 years because he was
a confession
without
that there's
a trial.
No way he could have written.
Exactly, because he was not competent to stand trial. They held him a Butner, but he never was taken to trial.
Remarkable. So you're talking about some changes that we made in North Carolina. How about with science and forensics? Have we made progress? I mean, of course, with the DNA abilities we have now, but what are the main advances that allow us to prevent this and get the right person?
Well, DNA has not only been a godsend as far as exculpatory evidence to prove someone's innocence, but it's also taught us that what we used to rely on as science were not sciences. If you have a wrongful conviction where someone was convicted based on tool mark evidence or bite mark evidence or fingerprint evidence, we now know that those were not reliable sciences. So we're going back and looking at those and making sure that we've tested them and peer-reviewed them and are bringing up raising the standards of reliability in those areas.
Is there a certain sense, though? I mean, I know in medicine, the better our tests get, the more there's unintended consequences sometimes of the test. Do people believe that all of the convictions that have been overturned, is there a backlash that somehow, oh, these people were really guilty, but they're getting off? Some unintended consequences of this technology in your work that you wouldn't have expected?
Well, I think it's twofold. The DNA exonerations are so great because that people just really
people
can't argue
that.
With that, yeah. That scientific proof. The non-DNA, you always have people who are skeptical about whether someone's really innocent or not. But we also hear, what about the wrongful acquittals? What about the people who are found not guilty? Why aren't you looking at those cases? Why are you only looking at the wrongfully convicted when there's more people who are acquitted who shouldn't be? And really, the policy changes we're putting in place impact both of those. They increase the reliability of convictions. They keep people from being acquitted because the jury is not sure and loses confidence. And they also ensure that we don't convict the innocent.
And are people concerned, like the general public, there's the issue with the trust in the system. But there's also some mistrust of DNA evidence. And the more we come up with new technologies, that the government's going to use that against us in some way. How do you respond to those kinds of concerns?
The privacy issues associated with tech. Well, because of the work I do, I'm a big supporter of DNA. I actually think people should give their DNA at birth. But I understand the privacy concerns. There's a lot of controls that are in place. And DNA is really the gold standard when it comes to scientific evidence. It's not the science behind DNA that causes problems. It's the humans.
Well, speaking of the humans, and we're talking with Christine Muma, lawyer and director of the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence, about the ethics of wrongful conviction. We have bad doctors that get sued. We have good doctors that get sued. But we do know that there are wrongful acts that are done. In the legal profession, what some of these cases I've noticed is that there's been some really unethical things done by some attorneys and others, maybe even doctors, I don't know, testifying or experts testifying. How has this process helped change, or can it help change that process? Or do you need legal process like lawsuits to change that process?
Well, there's bad apples in every profession, right? So you can't get away from that. But it's what we do to control that and to identify that and how we react to it when they're discovered. When you find errors, if there's a defensiveness rather than an acceptance and moving forward to improve the system, that's where you run into problems. I think the justice system overall has been slow to accept the need for continuous improvement. I have a corporate background before I went to law school, and corporate, it's all about continuous improvement. It's all about trying to improve every day, and
that's what we like to do.
We need more of that. We need more of that in the justice system. So there's, as the wrongful convictions are revealed, we learn more, and I think there's an acceptance now, more of an acceptance now, to go back and look at the way we did things before and make sure we did not commit errors.
Well, you know, thinking about the wrongfully accused, there's so much that saddens our heart. Think about 19 years. I mean, you were talking about Duane Allen Dale and the results and repercussions on his life and his family. But yet, because of your work and because of the center and the effort to bring the truth, you can also turn that around and see what you've done to change lives and what you are doing to offer these people a new future and some hope. So thank you for the work you're doing.
Thank you. I mean, the rewards of a Duane Dale or Greg Taylor are tremendous, but then the next day you go in and there's other cases, and there's cases that you have to close where you know someone's innocent and there's nothing you can do. So it's a never-ending process.
Well, we hope that maybe one day you work yourself out of a job. But thank you for being with us today on Your Health. We've been talking with Christine Mumma, Director of the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence, about the ethics of wrongful conviction. We appreciate you spending time with us.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show, we're going to spend a few minutes taking your questions and talking about our responses to those questions and concerns. And we're grateful to have some both by phone and by email today.
Yep, you can send us your questions at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can send us questions on Twitter, Facebook, visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Lots of ways, Christy, to get in touch with us, and we value all your questions. We got some really great ones today about people who have rashes and people...
About if a child sleeps too much, is that a concern? About estrogen and sunlight?
And then ultimately about restless legs.
And supplements.
Yep. So okay. Let's talk about our very first one. Someone sent us a question about their daughter and
let's
their
listen.
Foot.
So last night, my 3-year-old daughter came to us and was telling us that her foot was hurting, and we didn't see anything. But as the night progressed, her foot on the bottom and the top became red and swollen, hot to touch. I didn't see anything that looked like a spider bite or anything like that. But around the same time, and then this morning, she's had itchy hives on her. So I'm just curious if it could be some kind of bite that we just missed.
Well, that's kind of scary, I bet, you know, hearing pain and then all of a sudden breaking out in some redness and a rash.
Yeah, and it of course, a picture's worth 1,000 words, so it's hard. I'm picturing this really big, swollen, hot foot. But it sounds like maybe the next day that it wasn't that worrisome that you didn't take her in to see a doctor or anything, and that then she got these hives. So that does sound like she's reacting to something when you get those itchy hives.
Yeah, and while it could be a bite, most spider bites don't cause hives.
Right.
And typically the bites are painless for the kind, most of the kind we see. And even regular spider bites, not even the brown recluse or the black widow, but the regular ones are kind of, you know, painful there. And so I'm not so certain I would believe it's a spider bite. Other bug bites? Possible.
Maybe.
Possible. But you usually would see some sort of little punctate wound where that bug bit you.
And unfortunately, a lot of times when children and even adults develop hives or itchy parts and there's some reaction to something, we often don't find out exactly what it was. Usually we'd say to give a tiny bit of Benadryl or an antihistamine to try to reduce that.
With those hives. And I guess one thing I have seen is, you know, fire bites, fire ants.
Mm.
You know, they sometimes you don't see them and know the kid was walking around, but they got bit by fire ants. And those can be
a
lot of reactions to those. But again, the Benadryl is a really good thing. And
certainly if it gets worse, I'd definitely bring her in.
Topical cortisone.
Mm-hmm.
But a picture's worth 10,000 words here, yeah, Christy. So not even 1,000, 10,000.
If it doesn't go away, send us a picture,
hope
but go to
better,
your doctor.
And hope you, it's all gone.
Okay, let's have our next house call.
My 2.5-year-old daughter went to sleep last night at 9 o'clock, but then she didn't wake up until 11:30 the next day. Should I be worried?
Wow, that's great.
These two questions just speak to it's so hard to be a parent.
I love this if I'm a parent. You slept for 12 hours? Wow.
Awesome.
I could use that kind of sleep.
I know.
No, obviously there are some issues here of concern. And I understand that. I mean, you know, how much sleep is too much? If my child was, you know, and I can tell you having a teenager right now, about 1 p.m, I do sometimes think maybe my child should get up.
Is she okay?
Is she okay? Right. No, absolutely.
And, you know, it's so hard to be a parent to not really be able to have your children be able to tell you exactly what's going on.
And this is a 2.5-year-old. But, you know, what's a normal amount of sleep for a 2.5-year-old? 11 hours would not be totally unusual.
Well, and in this case, I guess it was more than 11 hours.
More than that, yeah.
But it also, I would want to know so much more. Like, did she have a nap? Does she normally nap? Did she have her nap around this time? Was there a change in her activity level? Were there other, like, any symptoms of having a sickness, an illness, fever, runny nose, anything to sort of
make sure
she
didn't get into your medicines?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Or my medicine cabinet, but, you know, someone's medicine cabinet or, you know, could have gotten hold of something. And those would always be concerns.
And if she woke up, if when you woke her up or she woke up, she was acting normally and eating and no signs of anything, then I wouldn't necessarily be worried about that. I'd take it as a blessing.
That's not going to continue.
Yeah, that's
tomorrow
probably.
Night, she's going to be back to the every wake up every 3 hours and pulling on your purse strings.
That's a really good, good point. So, I mean, if your child sleeps too long and you're concerned about it, it's totally reasonable. To go and check on them, make sure they don't have a rash and that they're breathing well and that sort of thing to reassure you. But usually you can start piecing together clues that give you some information.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to our very next house call about estrogen and sunlight.
And this is an email one, so I'll read this one. I take estrogen and the package directs the user to avoid natural and artificial sunlight. What are the consequences of sun exposure and how does it manifest itself?
Well, that's a good question, a good email, and we appreciate that question. And, you know, it's interesting, Christy, because, you know, if you do look on the package insert, it says... Where else? And if you look at the package insert, like birth control pills, which you have estrogen frequently, there's something similar. So I called some local dermatologists just to kind of check in with them about, well, do you caution patients about this? And they said, no, they don't. That there really is, it's written there, but it's exceedingly rare and it's not something they actually worry about.
Yeah, it's not something I counsel people about to avoid sunlight. There are other medications you do, but just routine birth control or estrogen.
Yeah, things like the tetracycline family and doxycycline is, you know, one of the drugs you have to worry about. Or if you have underlying conditions like lupus, you have to sometimes worry about sun sensitivity.
But in this case, I think you're okay. You want to be aware of the sun in general for sun protection. But...
Yeah, and I did do a quick literature search on PubMed, the official literature searching agent for all physicians in the country, and couldn't find really anything that was really specifically written in my quick search. So it's not frequent, even if it does occur. But certainly if you had a rash right after starting the drug, it's probably due to the drug. And in this case, probably haven't, probably okay.
Let's do our very last house call, which is an email from a special listener.
Yeah, Senator Eleanor Kennard wrote us and said, "Dear Drs. Goldstein, Page, and Zolotar, I read with interest your column on restless leg syndrome." This, I assume she read this, our column in the Carborough News. "I suffered from that and leg cramps at night for years before I discovered they were caused by supplemental vitamins and minerals, including even too much orange juice. As long as I have no supplemental vitamins and minerals, I have no symptoms. Since I'm older, I take 250 micrograms of B12. If I go over that amount, the symptoms return. When friends have complained about their symptoms, I ask if they're taking supplements, and they almost always are." Well, thank you.
Thank you so much, and thank you for taking the time to write us. And, you know, it makes a really good point, several good points. One is that a lot of times you have clues to your body and your health that your doctor might not pick up on. So that's important.
And it's like that narrative that we talked about with Dr. Meza when we had him on the show the week before last or so, about the need to listen to patients. And here, Senator Kennard has some really good wisdom to share with listeners and for others to listen to about, you know, a lot of supplements aren't not necessarily benign all of the time.
Well, and we've talked many times, Adam, about people taking all these different herbal supplements for various unknown possible health benefits. And there's not a lot of regulation on how much to take, how much is safe, and potential side effects. And so in this case, it sounds like it's linked to your symptoms. And good for you for figuring it out.
So if you're taking supplements and there's really no reason for you to be taking them, and you have some side of, or you're having some symptoms that you can't be explained, maybe one of the things you can do, as Senator Kennard suggests, is to stop the supplement. Well, that's going to conclude our house calls today, and we've had a chance to talk about supplements as well as sleeping.
A little bit about estrogen and sunlight.
And finally, about swelling from a leg and possible bite and taking Benadryl. So thanks for listening in with us today. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. You certainly can visit us at all the ways we talked about, and you should know that free podcasts are always available now of our show in the iTunes store.
And we do want to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and we want to thank our guest today, Christine Mumma, for being with us and for the work that she is doing. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.